Iran's foreign minister says Iraq's problems must be solved through legal channels while preserving the country's stability, peace and national unity. Deadly clashes erupt in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, as political tensions escalate in the country, leaving over a dozen people dead and hundreds injured. And Syria counting the cost, it says. US occupying forces and terror groups have inflicted more than $107 billion in losses on the country's oil. Thank you for joining us. A top story this hour, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the current problems in neighboring Iraq must be solved through legal channels. He made the remark in a meeting with his visiting counter, Iraqi counterpart rather, Fuad Hossein, just hours before the latest spike in political violence in the Arab country. Iran's top diplomat highlighted the need for preserving Iraq's stability, peace and national unity. Amir Abdollahian called on all political groups to show respect for Iraq's legal institutions and the government's authority. Iraq has been in a political deadlock since last October's general elections, with rival parties failing to agree on the formation of a new government. During his meeting with Amir Abdollahian, the Iraqi foreign minister stressed that the security of Iran and Iraq are intertwined. Hossein emphasized that his country won't allow its territory to be used as a platform for threats against Iran. Iraq is once again in the grip of worsening political turmoil. Deadly clashes erupt in the capital, Baghdad, after cleric Muqtada al-Sadr announced he is withdrawing from politics. Fifteen people have lost their lives and 350 others are injured in clashes after Saad supporters broke into Baghdad's fortified Green Zone. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse the crowd and sounds of gunshots were also heard in the city. It prompted the suspension of cabinet sessions until further notice. Iraq's Joint Operations Command has imposed a curfew in the capital. Earlier in the day, Saad said he is quitting politics in response to a prolonged political deadlock.
I decided to withdraw from the political process so as not to be involved with the corrupt politicians, neither in this world nor the hereafter.
Saad has slammed other Iraqi leaders for not heeding to his calls for reform. He did not elaborate on the closure of his offices, but said some of his cultural and religious institutions would remain open. The announcement comes as Saad supporters continue their sit-in outside the Supreme Judicial Council in Baghdad to step up pressure on the body to dissolve parliament. Iraq has been without a government or a head of state for months. Last parliamentary election saw an alliance led by Saad winning most seats, but he failed to form a government. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the re-establishment and enhancement of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will benefit regional security. Raisi made the remark in a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hossein. He hailed Iraq's initiatives for improving cooperation among regional countries free of foreign meddling. Raisi noted that five rounds of Iraq's mediated talks between Tehran and Riyadh have been positive and useful. Iran's president said the full implementation of agreements reached in previous talks would pave the way for further promotion of interactions. For his part, the Iraqi foreign minister vowed that his country would continue efforts to improve Tehran-Riyadh ties. Saudi Arabia severed diplomatic relations with Iran in January 2016. This came after Iranian protesters, enraged by Saudi execution of prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Baghir al-Nimr, stormed its diplomatic missions in Iran. Iranian officials condemned the attack and perpetrators were prosecuted and sentenced to prison. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has reiterated Iran's conditions for an agreement on the revival of the JCPOA. He says the deal hinges on the settlement of safeguards issues between Tehran and the UN nuclear agency. This as Tehran is studying the US response to its amendments on an EU proposal to salvage the accord. We have a report on this.
Over 16 months of on-and-off discussions over the revival of the JCPOA appear to be nearing an end, with Tehran reviewing the US response to its amendments on a recent EU draft proposal aimed at reviving the accord. The negotiations started after US President Joe Biden took power on a pledge to correct the mistakes of his predecessor, Donald Trump. That's the man who unilaterally abandoned JCPOA in 2018 and launched the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. President Ebrahim Raisi has now reiterated Iran's conditions for an agreement. They include the settlement of safeguards issues between Iran and the UN nuclear agency.
What have been raised are first assuring guarantees. Second, the verification of the sanctions removal in an objective and practical manner. Third, the removal of sanctions in a meaningful and sustainable way. And fourth, an end to what I call political accusations regarding safeguard issues.
Raisi argued that it's pointless to restore the deal without putting an end to those safeguards accusations. He was referring to the IAEA recently asking Iran to provide explanations for what it called traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran says these are baseless accusations coming from Israel. In his presser, Raisi was asked to comment on Israel's recent threats that it won't be bound by a JCPOA revival agreement and it will do everything to prevent Iran from attaining a nuclear capability. The president said the regime can never hinder Iran's nuclear progress.
The Zionist regime's threats against Iran have led to nowhere. The assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists was meant to stop Iran's progress in the nuclear field, but we were not stopped. Many acts of sabotage and seditions were aimed at stopping us, but we were not stopped. And no measure by the Zionist regime and the arrogant powers will stop Iran from its right to obtain nuclear energy.
Deal or no deal, Iran appears set to resolve its sanctions problems once and for all. Raisi says Tehran pursues efforts to nullify the sanctions concurrent with its efforts to get the sanctions removed. He cited a huge boost in Iran's exports since his government was formed last year, pointing to a five-fold increase in Iran's trade with regional countries.
Syria says the US terrorists and separatists have cost it over $107 billion in losses in the oil, gas and mineral sectors since 2011. The Syrian Foreign Ministry said and made the announcement in separate letters to the Secretary General of the United Nations and the President of the Security Council. It said terrorists, groups and separatist Kurdish forces in northeastern Syria are looting, smuggling and illegally trading the country's resources. The ministry stressed that such violations are committed under the protection and with the support of the US forces illegally present in Syria. It is the so-called international coalition led by the US also, which has also been carrying out bombing and aggression on Syrian oil and gas facilities. It says Syria's oil, gas and minerals production has also plummeted due to such hostile actions. The ministry called on the UN to deal with the humanitarian and economic situation in Syria with more seriousness and efficiency. The Israeli blockade continues to claim the lives of Palestinian patients in the Gaza Strip. A six-year-old baby boy has died after Israel refused to grant him an exit permit from the besieged enclave. Ashraf Shannon has more details in the following report from Gaza.
Rights groups have condemned the death of a six-year-old Palestinian boy, Farouk Abu Naja, who died last week in Gaza after Israel denied him an exit permit to travel to Al-Quds for urgent medical care. Four patients, including three children, have died so far this year because of the inhumane Israeli practice. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished territory can be a stressful and unpredictable process.
Israel is fully responsible for the death of the child according to the Fourth Geneva Convention. This case is yet another example of Israel's continuous violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. Denying access to necessary medical care for a child is unwarranted and grave.
We met with the family of Farouk Abu Najah in the southern Gaza Strip, town of Khan Yunis.
When Farouk was born, he was a healthy child, but at the age of 3, he started showing signs of sickness and weakness. His health started to deteriorate, and he was diagnosed with cerebral atrophy. Doctors in Gaza referred him to a hospital in Al-Quds. We applied for an Israeli permit twice, but we were told that his care is under security review. Israel killed my son. Farouk died Wednesday night while waiting for the permit.
Over 1,000 Palestinian patients have lost their lives in the Gaza Strip since 2007. The large number of deaths highlights the lethal impact of Israel's crippling blockade on nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the coastal enclave.
The crippling Israeli blockade and the arbitrary restriction have battered the health sector in Gaza. Hospitals suffer from acute shortage of essential drugs and medical devices and insufficient number of specialized health professionals. Local hospitals are unable to treat many serious diseases, and so raising the number of patients referred for treatment abroad.
Hospitals in the Gaza Strip lack many essential drugs they need to treat patients suffering from severe illnesses. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many patients is likely to further deteriorate.
The Israeli blockade has had a devastating impact on the health and the well-being of people in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Hundreds of Palestinian patients have already lost their lives in recent years in the besieged enclave due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
France has warned companies about the risk of energy rationing amid a surge in gas prices caused by the war in Ukraine. We discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
France warns its companies about the risk of energy rationing this winter as Russia slashes gas supply to European countries. The French Prime Minister urged companies to reduce their consumption. She said each company should draw up its own energy-saving plan by September. She said that the government would be forced to impose cuts if businesses don't take precautionary measures. France has been less affected than many European countries from the surge in gas prices caused by the war in Ukraine. 70% of the country's electricity comes from nuclear reactors. However, most are currently offline. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent from Paris, Kristen Hund, and also Mahmoud Arafat, president of the European Institute for International Law from Stockholm. Let's begin with our correspondent, Chris. It seems that the French are also feeling the pinch now, aren't they?
Yes, French officials warn that gas cuts might be possible this winter. Even if France is less reliant on the Russian gas supplies than Germany, for instance, there is still one quarter of the electricity production that is linked to the gas supply. Eventual sanctions from Russia on the gas supply could impact France. Now there is a second problem for France. First of all, the officials say they are filling the gas reserves before November, but even with full gas reserves, they admit that it will not be enough if there is a severe gas supply cut from Moscow. So the second problem for France is they are largely dependent on nuclear energy production, and they have an aging nuclear power plants. So a half of the nuclear power plants today, they are not functioning because of maintenance and or because of safety concerns. So there is a push for a transformation towards renewable energy, but Germany is going fast towards the use of solar panels, but France is still sticking on its nuclear power plants production, and that might be a serious problem for the following years.
Okay, so Mr. Rafati, you just heard what our correspondent said from Paris on the ground there. How far do you think Europeans can continue without Russian gas supplies? And when do you think they will eventually have to go back on their policies?
Well, let me start from the speech of President Macron, the French President Macron, a few days ago when he spoke very frankly to the French people, saying, well, you must understand the prosperous days have gone, and you must be ready for difficult days. The coming days are difficult days. These are the words of the French President Emmanuel Macron. And these words reflect how the situation is difficult in general. We are aware that both France and Germany are the biggest economic powers in the EU, in the European Union. Accordingly, they are the most consumptive aspect and the most consumer of the gas and the energy with its with all its sectors, I mean petroleum, electricity, etc. And most of energy used now in the French and German industry are by the gas, are run by the gas. And from here, it's coming the catastrophe of the cut off of the Russian gas. We don't forget, we mustn't forget also, the consequences now started already by the shutdown and the fall down of the value of the euro against the US dollar because of this crisis in general. So again, I would repeat the phrases of President Macron, which resumed the situation in Europe. The prosperous days have gone, and we must be ready for the difficult days. The coming days are difficult days if policies are not changed and a suitable situation, a suitable solution as well, is found with President Putin and with Moscow in general. And the big lines are adopted for this solution. There will be real problems in Europe for next years.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry we're running out of time. We're going to have to end this here. Chris Den Hund from Paris, our correspondent, and Mr. Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law from Stockholm. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Well, those were the top stories. Thank you for choosing us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The Zionist regime's ongoing war against the Palestinians aims to extinguish their spirit of resistance, but they have become even more steadfast in their fight for justice and liberation, says Sami Al-Aryan, writer, in an article published under the heading Zionist Regime Attacks, Western Collusion, and the High Price of Palestinian Freedom. Stay tuned for more. On the morning of Friday, August 5th, 5-year-old Ala Qadoum woke up in her Shajaiya home in the center of Gaza, excited that her grandfather would be coming to take her to buy a new school uniform and backpack. She had been dreaming of that day all summer ahead of her first day of kindergarten in just a few weeks. But before Ala could set out on her shopping trip, her home was hit by an Israeli regime airstrike. She was killed instantly. In Rafah, in the south of Gaza, Abir Harb, a 24-year-old student studying information technology, went to visit her fiancé, 30-year-old Ismail Dawig, to go over wedding plans. Ismail, who looked after his elderly mother, owned a small business he had been hoping to grow in order to provide for expanding family. Abir was very happy that day because Ismail had phoned her father for permission to set a wedding date, but the meeting never happened. A day later, Ismail's body was recovered from the under the rubble of his home. He was found tightly hugging his mother as their house was obliterated by an Israeli regime missile. On the same day, in the Jabalia refugee camp in north of Gaza, Najwa Abu Hamda was not prepared for the devastating news she was about to receive. Her 19-year-old son, Khalil, had been killed in an airstrike. Just that morning, Najwa, who struggled for 15 years before having her only child through fertilization, told neighbors that she and her husband hoped Khalil would get married soon and bless them with grandchildren. Their hopes for the future are irrevocably destroyed by this unimaginable loss. In the Bourajji refugee camp in the east of Gaza, 45-year-old Sheikh Yasser tried to soothe his three children as the terrifying hum of Israeli regime warplanes hovered above. Within a few minutes, however, the judicial officer and part-time religious teacher, his 13-year-old twins Muhammad and Dalia, and his 9-year-old son Ahmad were incinerated by an Israeli regime missile. Only Yasser's mother and wife survived. The next day, on August 6, in the Jabalia refugee camp, 11-year-old Rahaf Soleiman stepped out of her house at around sunset to call out to her brother to come home for dinner. Without any warning, she was hit by a Zionist regime missile, causing the tiny girl to lose her right hand and both legs. Regardless of which part of Gaza one lived, 45 Palestinians, half of whom were women and children, were killed. In those 55 hours of hell, more than 360 others were injured and maimed because of the Zionist regime's appetite to punish, target, and subjugate Palestinians in Gaza. The Zionist regime's military aggression began that morning with an unprovoked targeted assassination of a commander of Islamic Jihad, one of the main Palestinian resistance groups. The use of violence has long been a tactic by Israeli regime leaders in the midst of their election campaigns for political gain. Shimon Peres tried it during his political campaign in April 1996. When the Zionist regime committed the Kano massacre, killing more than 100 children. As he was launching his re-election campaign, Ehud Olmert waged a devastating three-week war on Gaza in December 2008, which claimed the lives of 1,400 Palestinians, including nearly 500 women and children, with thousands more injured. In May 2021, as Benjamin Netanyahu was preparing for his own re-election bid after several inconclusive elections, he unleashed the full force of the Israeli regime killing machine for 12 days on Gaza, resulting in more than 260 Palestinians killed and thousands more injured, and thousands of homes, buildings, and businesses destroyed. Similarly, the war this month was an attempt by the current Israeli regime leaders, Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, to gain political ground over right-wing opposition leader Netanyahu before heading to the polls in November. Interestingly enough, all Israeli regime leaders mentioned lost their re-election bids after none of these military campaigns managed to achieve their goal of vanquishing the enemy and gaining a decisive victory. But what has been consistent throughout the Zionist regime's vicious wars is Western leaders' callous mantra that Israel has the right to defend itself, ruthlessly giving the fake regime of Israel a license to kill any Palestinian it perceives as a threat or an obstacle to its designs. By colluding with the fabricated regime of Israel, Western governments have been sending an unmistakable message that Palestinian lives are expendable. Freedom and human rights do not matter. The rule of law, democratic values, justice and equality are selective, and security and peace are not universal guarantees. Yet Palestinians are not oblivious to the tremendous sacrifices they have endured against the assault of the Zionist regime for decades. Palestinians mourn every victim and cry over every child. There is not a Palestinian home that is not scarred by a tragedy of a loved one killed, maimed, injured, arrested, or imprisoned, or a home demolished, bombed, or razed, a land confiscated, or a tree uprooted. Each time the Zionist regime launches an attack on Palestinians, it aims to extinguish their spirit of resistance and pressure them to give up their rights. But in the face of such brutality and disregard for human life, the people become even more determined and steadfast in their fight for justice and freedom. Sooner or later, the world will recognize that the path of ignoring the plight of millions of people by supporting a settler colonialist project and arming it with superior military power against children, mothers, young brides and grooms, and ordinary people is immoral and unsustainable. Conscientious people across the world know that as well, as Nelson Mandela had once observed. We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends. Today is the tragic first of the month of Safar, the day when survivors of the massacre of the Prophet's progeny at Karbala were unjustly dragged to the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus. Let us contemplate today on the words of the Holy Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, when she boldly told the tyrant Yazid about the illegitimacy of his rule. Those who have helped you to become the head of the Muslim state have done a big disservice to Islam and will soon know what awaits them.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Methods of Respecting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of methods of respecting in Islamic lifestyle. When we see the human life, we see that the human being or the mankind has relations with different people, and on the basis of those relations, they deal or they socialize with the people. And sometimes we have our relatives next to us, our close relatives like mother, brother, sister, son, daughter. These are the close ones. On the second hand, we have our neighbors who are living next to us. On the third number, when we go to the work, we have colleagues with whom we work, the manager or the general colleagues. Therefore, our socializing depends on the way of connection that we have with these people. And the first thing that comes to our mind, that how should or which methods should I acquire in order to respect the others? Up to what extent can I respect the others? There are no such rules, but there are many things that are said, and there are different ways. For example, it is said to respect the others while you in your speech when you talk. But on the other hand, if we want to know that what to do and what is the main criteria, what are the limits of respecting others, we have a saying from one of the greatest scholars who is known as Shahid Thani, who said that it is permissible to respect to a believer as much as it is customary. As much as it is customary. So we need to look at the custom of a place. For example, in one place they shake hand. On the other place they hug each other when they meet. There must be some other customs. Therefore, we should do those customs in the limits of Islam, and if it is within the limits of Islam, it is allowable. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of methods of respect in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that Shahid Thani has said that it is permissible to bow to a believer or the respect to a believer as much as it is customary, and it depends on the customs. Therefore, we need to apply or we need to respect others according to the customs that are in that place, but in the limits of Islam. For example, if Islam has stopped us from shaking hands with non-mahram, we should not perform that, even if it is the custom of the others. Rather, we can lower our heads, or with the respect, we can say hello or something like that, and we reply them. But it should be in the premises or the limitations of the Islam. It should be in the boundaries of Islam. The first method, which is being said in the Islamic teachings, is that you must respect others through your speech. Because first thing, when we see each other, we talk to each other. We move our lips and tongue. And with this speech, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, وَقُولُوا لِلنَّاسِ حُسْنًا. Talk to the people in a good manner. Talk to the people in a good manner. Even if for the Musa alayhi salam, when he was going to confront the throne of his time, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, قُولُوا. Allah said, قُلْ لَهُمَا قَوْلًا كَرِيمًا. Talk with them in a merciful way. Talk to them in a good way so that he comes towards you. When you're talking to your parents, Allah says, it is the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, that قُلْ لَهُمَا, say to both of them, كَرِيمًا, قَوْلًا كَرِيمًا, in an honorable way. Where you must talk to your parents. You must not shout in front of your parents. So it depends. The person that you're socializing, the person you're communicating with, you need to talk them in that way. And when we are talking with the needy, those who raise their hand, those who are in need, Allah says that, فَقُلْ لَهُمْ قَوْلًا مَيْسُورًا. Talk with them in a respectful way so they are not feeling being humiliated. So talk with them in a respectful way and refuse them with respect if you do not have anything to help them. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Some gardens are decorated with genomes and other cute ornaments, but this garden uses tank debris to stand out amongst others. The intention of the gardener isn't to have the most army-themed patch. Valeria tried to remove the tank, but ultimately because of its size and weight, it was impossible. So he just let it stay. The owner says he is used to having the tank there, even though it reminds him of hard times. Next to the wreckage, this family has planted cabbage and potatoes, which they harvest and use each year. The tank was left over from the war between Russia and Ukraine that began earlier this year.
The evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The four-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured three major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing.
Living through a pandemic is strange as we are often locked indoors, but a UK-based Indian mechanical engineer made the best use of his time during the coronavirus lockdown and built an airplane. 38-year-old Ashok Ali Serial, who is also a private pilot, had long dreamt of a personal aircraft. He initially planned to order an aircraft kit and built it with his colleagues. But he says the 2020 lockdown left him with no choice but to complete it on his own. Now he has an aircraft which he has named after his youngest daughter, Dia. The plane can carry up to four people, including the pilot, and fly about 250 kilometers an hour. After getting clearance to fly, he flew across four European countries with his friends. He has also gone on a trip with his family of four.
Age does not matter, it's the heart that counts. A Guatemalan female footballer has proved that there is no point one should worry about the age. 57-year-old Alma Salazar has a passion for soccer and takes care of her team's goalpost. Known as Flying Granny, she launches herself and deflects a ball that's looking for the nets. The passion for the sport was born when she was 19 years old. She started training with a men's team where she often found a place as a goalkeeper. Since then, Alma has played for several professional and amateur football clubs. In her room that overlooks a local stadium, Alma keeps trophies she has won on a table, most of them as the least defeated goalkeeper. Locals praise her as an unbeatable goalkeeper. An inflatable building that explores how people would potentially live on Mars has been unveiled in the British city of Bristol. It's a two-story structure with an area of 570 square feet powered by solar panels. It's designed to cope with temperatures as low as minus 63 degrees Celsius. Although the Martian house will be displayed above ground, its lower level will be fully buried to maximize protection against the harsh environment on Mars. Inside, the top floor features a hydroponic living room filled with decorative plants that feed into a circular wastewater system. A team of experts helped develop the design, taking into consideration the complexity of transporting materials to the red planet and what is already there.
So in the gold inflatable structure which you see above you, that's the main living space of the Martian house. It's gold to reflect dangerous solar rays and cosmic radiation, and it's inflatable because it would be filled with a special concrete made of the dust and water that you find on Mars, again to protect you from those dangerous solar and cosmic rays.
The Martian house was envisioned by local artists 7 years ago. The artists also brought together space scientists, architects, engineers, designers, and even school children. The space-age dwelling explores what a house on Mars could be like and is meant to for research and experiments about the future. The major objective of the project, however, is to provoke questions about living more sustainably with the resources at hand here on Earth.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Japanese plastic food artisans are showcasing their mouth-watering artificial creations at an exhibition in Japan's capital city, Tokyo. From the Leaning Tower of Pizza to fish slicing and cooking, or even the quirky stacked pancakes, you can find almost everything at the exhibit. Other sculptures, including a deep-fried shrimp with full breaded legs scaling a mountain of shredded cabbage like a tiger. Another creation on display is a Tetris game made of chicken. Plastic food artists get really excited for the exhibition each year as they are given a chance to practice their own spin on creativity, bringing food to life with curious characters.
So normally we have to follow orders from clients. We take their views on board when we're making items. Normally that's our work. But for the competition, you can use your imagination. How it finally ends up is totally up to you. I like that aspect of it.
There are some 60 sculptors on display. Some are silly, but others highlight the artist's skills. The models were made with the same careful detail as the rock-solid noodle soups and crispy-looking plastic snacks on display outside Japanese restaurants. There is a lucrative business for them in Japan.
Deforest management plays a key role in mitigating climate change. Like many world countries, China has accelerated environmental and social structural changes in urban spaces to deal with this pertinent issue. The Donggu Forest Park is one such project that has provided city dwellers enough space to breathe. It comes into being from what local people usually called rotten woods. The park on the northern bank of the Xiaolinge River covers an area of nearly 120 hectares. Nobody would come there before, as the place was full of flies and mosquitoes. But now, with the environment improved and water cleaned in the river, the place has turned into a wonderland, attracting locals and even foreign tourists.
Now the sky is blue, the water clean and the air fresh, with green greeting you wherever you go. The elderly play Tai Chi or do bodybuilding exercises here. Young people play football, basketball and table tennis.
Over the past 20 years, a large number of cities in China have undergone a brief but rapid urban expansion. Most of these cities are now facing social problems such as an aging population and a high prevalence of chronic diseases. A comprehensive environmental improvement program in the area was initiated in 2014 in order to create space for those who want to take a break from their everyday works.
Whilst not being as painful as a broken limb, animals like humans suffer from chronic and acute pain from gum infections, broken teeth, and bacterial spread through the circulation. A 16-year-old elephant in Pakistan is one such case. Madhubala, suffering for years from a dental infection caused by a broken tusk, has finally got relief thanks to vets, dentists. Named after a legendary Indian actress, Madhubala's eyes were taped shut, her legs tied to support her during sedation and subsequent treatment at a Karachi zoo. The vets had to use drills and other heavy surgical tools to extract the infected tusk. She is one of four African elephants being treated in Karachi by an eight-member team from Global Animal Welfare Group, Four Paws. A Pakistani court last year asked Four Paws to assess the health of the animals after local animal rights activists raised concerns about their well-being. England's Paradise Wildlife Park welcomes its new guest, an endangered red panda cub. The mother, Tilly, gave birth to the cub just 1 month after she lost her breeding partner, Nampang. Experts say Tilly had been under a breeding project for 4 years. The cub has been named Little Red, and his birth is being celebrated as a quote, symbol of hope. Red pandas are classed as an endangered species and are on the red list of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The bushy-tailed bamboo munchers dwell in high-altitude Asian forests, and their population is now fewer than 2,500. Lightning strikes are very powerful and misunderstood force of nature that we all often see being used in films. A spectacular lightning strike has illuminated the sky over the Scottish town of Dundee. A video from an eyewitness that captured the hypnotic scene has been shared on several social media platforms. The lightning in the clip can be seen sending several bolts in opposite directions. Below, a church spire is silhouetted against the lightning flashes. But lightning is not always spectacular, as sometimes it causes fire to tower and high rises. Last month, a wind turbine caught fire after being struck by a lightning bolt in North Texas, United States. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with menu expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice, and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden has mocked former President Donald Trump for claiming that he secretly declassified all of the classified documents that were recovered by the FBI during the Mar-a-Lago raid. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Ida Slisko. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Joe Biden Mocks Donald Trump Over Claim He Declassified Everything. President Joe Biden has mocked former President Donald Trump for claiming that he secretly declassified all of the classified documents that were recovered by the FBI during the Mar-a-Lago raid. Joe Biden cracked a smile and appeared to be close to laughing outside of the White House on Friday, 26th of August, after a reporter pointed out that Donald Trump said that he declassified all those documents that are currently the subject of a Department of Justice investigation. President Biden dismissed the question on whether Donald Trump had the power to just declassify them all by mockingly stating that he had just declassified everything in the world, while also insisting that he was not going to comment on the matter. "Well, I just want you to know I've declassified everything in the world," Biden said after grinning. "I'm the president, I can do it all. Come on, declassified everything? I'm not going to comment because I don't know the details. I don't even want to know. I'll let the Justice Department take care of it." When asked if it was ever appropriate for a president to take home classified and top secret documents, Joe Biden said that it depends on the circumstances. He was not asked whether it was appropriate for a president to keep classified documents at home after leaving office. President Biden said that he was taking home his own daily intelligence briefings on Friday, 26th of August, but stipulated that he had a completely secure area that he would be reading it in, while accompanied by a member of the military, and will be returning the document to military personnel just after reading it. Multiple boxes of classified documents, including some marked top secret and some that reportedly may have included nuclear secrets, were recovered during the August 8 raid on Mar-a-Lago. Joe Biden has insisted that he did not know about the raid ahead of time and that he's not involved in the ongoing Department of Justice investigation into whether Donald Trump's taking of official documents broke multiple federal laws, including the Espionage Act. Trump has called the raid a break-in in multiple Truth Social posts and suggested that President Biden was involved in planning the raid and what he called a political witch hunt targeting him. On Friday, 26th of August, the former president expressed outrage over the release of the redacted affidavit that was used to justify the Mar-a-Lago search warrant. Donald Trump had demanded that the full unredacted version of the affidavit be released to the public. The Department of Justice opposed releasing the affidavit over concerns that it could jeopardize an ongoing investigation and the safety of witnesses, including confidential informants in Donald Trump's orbit, at risk. The version that was released on Friday, 26th of August, following an order from Judge Bruce Reinhardt, was heavily redacted and obscured any clues about the identities of the informants. However, experts, including Trump-friendly former attorney Alan Dershowitz, have said that the affidavit likely gives the Department of Justice enough evidence to indict the former president if an indictment is pursued. Donald Trump lashed out at the redactions on Truth Social soon after the affidavit was released, accusing the federal authorities of participating in public relations subterfuge. "Affidavit heavily redacted," Trump wrote. "Nothing mentioned on nuclear, a total public relations subterfuge by the FBI and Department of Justice, or our close working relationship regarding document turnover. We gave them much. Judge Bruce Reinhardt should never have allowed the break-in into my home." The affidavit unsealed on Friday by Judge Bruce Reinhardt revealed that national defense information was stored inside boxes in Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home. The FBI wrote in the 32-page redacted affidavit that includes partial and completely blacked-out pages that there is probable cause and evidence of obstruction in reference to the discovery of 184 classified documents found in 14 of 15 boxes.